Welcome back to another Hacking Finance podcast, where myself, David Galbraith, partner at Anthemis, and Sean Park, Anthemis founder, are going to talk this time about crypto, given that it's now morphed into something even bigger than it was before, become crazier than it was before, and also become more exciting than it was before. So I was going to...
That's kick... even possible, David.
I know. It's gone from really crazy to, well, you can't even, you know, stranger than fiction at the moment in terms of jokes of joke coins being worth billions and various sort of nefarious activities happening on various exchanges and all sorts of really deep structural changes that are both reminiscent of Web 1, which wasn't called Web 1, and reminiscent of Web 2 in terms of that previous period of decentralization around file sharing, all under this new banner, which is Web 3. So I was going to kick off with what do you think of Web 3? Is it real? Is it a term that has currency?
Yeah, I think probably the wrong person to ask this because I'm, you know, a bit of a pedant when it comes to these sort of things. But it's like fintech, right? I think it is, you know, my instinct is to say, oh no, it's like this vast generalization that means something different to everyone and it's complicated. But the new me, the more grown up me maybe is, actually, I think it is useful because it acts as, it's a little bit like, you know, I don't know the actual term Web3, my understanding is that's like the iteration from Tim O'Reilly's Web 2.0. So I'm not sure that analogy is ideal or perfect. But again, coming back to like the fintech thing that I used to hate and I still don't really love as a moniker, I appreciate as a useful shorthand that creates, you know, helps catalyze and creates a center of gravity in terms of a movement. You know, intellectual, financial, societal, etc. So yeah, I think it is probably useful, but the disclaimer is that it's a catch-all, and at least for now, can mean sort of anything to anyone. So
before we to do be, that,
for those that are, you know, new, you know, I think you just need to be careful as to like if we were meeting for the first time and talking about this. An ideal world, there'd be sort of like, okay, what do you think it means? What do I think it means? To make sure that you're on the same, you know, wavelength. And it doesn't even matter what that wavelength is. But I think the only downside is it probably will lead to, you know, a bit of sort of noise and muddiness in terms of the discussions because but that's fine.
Just to be pedantic, isn't it? Pedant, not pedant. I've always wanted to try that.
I don't know. I'm Canadian. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I always wanted to correct someone on the term pedantic.
You're probably right, actually. I don't know. We should look
speaking that up. Speaking of that, words do actually matter. And it's one of the weird things about information technology is it relies on standards. It relies on people all agreeing on stuff.
Yeah.
And that even matters at the level of jargon around a scene. And we've seen this sort of more from blockchain, which was too corporate, so it was not cool. So people
saw but it was crypto, but then it's not crypto, it's blockchain.
Yeah.
It's not blockchain, yeah. It's DeFi or...
Yeah, exactly. So it more so each has its own scene, but definitely Web3 seems to be the next iteration of crypto where it's sort of more inclusive, if you like, of some other things. Whether it sticks or not, I do think that the internet sort of beds down layers, like sedimentary layers of things that are common goods, if you like. And the first common good was the networks themselves, where before you had CompuServe and AOL and you dial up and like part of the service was the access to the network. And then that was hived off and that became a commodity, if you like. And that was done by the telcos. And at this point, we're seeing financial services infrastructure being a commodity like that. And I think regardless of what happens now, we will see all of financial services running over the internet. And when we mean running over the internet, we mean running over the crypto net or whatever this thing is.
But don't you think that's the case already? Or just to be, I mean... what isn't running over the internet?
I should say it's running over the internet, but it's not running over the web, and it's not running in apps. It's running very specifically in apps that were like file sharing apps that are combinations of clients and servers. And so because they're hybrid client servers, they're distributed. And because of that nature, that is something different. It means you don't need an intermediary for a lot of the types of financial exchanges, transactions, products, whatever that are needed. So they're much more efficient. And so I think that's permanent regardless. And I think you will see,
To be pedantic, I think that's how you pronounce that, but whether you need an intermediary or not doesn't always answer the question whether you want an intermediary or whether it's desirable to have an intermediary or not.
Yeah, I know. And we've seen, the era, the web one, the first phase of the web was very like now, very like the sort of NFT scene now. Yeah, I don't know if you remember, there was a magazine called Mondo 2000 that predated Wired. And the aesthetics of that magazine. The aesthetics of that magazine. So this was pre-Wired. So this is, it's called Mondo 2000 because the year 2000 was in the future then. And that was, and it had an aesthetic was very consciously digital, a bit like NFTs do. Like the artwork wasn't trying to look like a photograph or something. It was trying to look like it was made by a computer. And it had, Jaron Lanier wearing a VR headset on the cover and things like this. Like this stuff is a repeat of that scene. But there was...
What happened to him?
He is still, so interestingly, he did a series for the New York Times. We did some work with him at Anthemis actually with the Omidyar Group.
Okay.
So he had with the Omidyar Group, we were looking at the future of work and guilds and the idea of what happens in the gig economy to people's, let's say, their healthcare and things like that. And so he had a very, very good analysis of this. So it was very DAO-like. And he did a series for the New York Times where he explained these modern guilds and how they might work, how you might have annuity streams from your attention, et cetera. And so you are seeing these people from that early sort of Mondo 2000 scene being relevant now. You've got Bram Cohen, who did BitTorrent, doing the Geo Network. Let's say you've got people like Jaron Lanier looking at distributed organizations. These people have come back on the scene. And like you say, O'Reilly, who coined the term Web 2.0, well, the conference that became Web 2.0 was originally called Peer-to-Peer. And that was a conference around distributed technologies, i.e. around file sharing. So there are many aspects that are repeating, and that's why I think analyzing the history of this stuff, because it's not new. The technology is not new. It's certainly updated. The architecture is new, and the people are new that are involved to some extent, but it's incremental, not revolutionary, whereas most people think it's revolutionary.
Well, when you say most people, is that most people that are involved in it that are under 35 years old, or is it just most people?
Partly, yeah. No, it's partly a generational thing. You get generations of people who are very creative in their mid to late 20s who rebuild the world every generation, and this is why it's Web 3.
I raise that because I think it's really interesting, and again, maybe an older version of me would have been more cynical or patronizing about it. I think now I just find it interesting and try to, where's that middle ground? And I remember going to when was that? It was certainly pre-COVID, but it wasn't that long ago, maybe 5 years ago, going to like a crypto conference in Zug in Switzerland, Crypto Valley, and watching a really fascinating presentation by, I can't remember his name now, he's a super young guy, now he's probably a billionaire, quite famous in the crypto space, who basically gave a 45-minute workshop on securities clearing and settlement, except for he didn't know that he didn't use that language, but he just talked through, the infrastructure and how you'd have in the context of crypto assets. And he basically did it from first principles. And I thought it was fascinating on the one hand, thinking, well, like, dude, hello, like there is literally a $1 trillion industry and companies like Euroclear and DTCC and all the rest of it doing that. And absolutely that is, you know, a crucial infrastructure for any kind of market where there's transactions, decentralized or not. But then, you know, and that was a sort of maybe less, more, again, cynical, arms crossed, like really, like, hello, educate yourself. And then, but then I very quickly flipped to, no, this is actually interesting. And it, you know, not to be too cliche about it, it was like the beginner's mind, right? And, you know, by thinking about it from first principles in the context of something slightly different or new, there's probably a lot to unpack there and learn, right? And there's probably a lot that was the same, you know, the 90% of the DNA is the same, but everything interesting happens in that 10%. And so, you know, subsequent to that, I've tried to keep an open mind and actually focus when any of these things come up on, you know, not what's the same or what sort of fundamental, like universal truths, if that even exists, but what is different, new, novel, either in terms of concept or in terms of what is possible because of these technologies.
Yeah. And I think you're right. So there are two things that prompt me from that. So one is where the creativity is really weird, because if you take NFTs, the creativity, it's equivalent of people running an art gallery and then be less interested in the paintings and more interested in the accounting system that's running the art gallery. It's like all the creative, the real creativity is weird, nerdy back-end stuff, and the art's actually not that interesting, which is fine, because the art is not the point. The receipt is the point. The innovation is in the receipt. You have the artwork can be copied. The receipt is immortal.
But that's not new either, right? That's Bernard Arnault is the world's richest man because he figured that out.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. When you buy a Birkin bag, you can buy a fake Birkin bag, but no, you're spying the signaling. And I think Matt Levine had it right when he said that NFTs were transactional ostentation. I think he's unfair that that's going to be permanent. I think they will start from a status signaling point and evolve into royalty sharing and all sorts of things. But it's weird that it started with that. And I think it's no accident that, as you mentioned, going to Zug, where Zug was the center of the ICO movement. And if you look at ICOs, none of them have actually really resulted in any platforms with any residual user base or value, apart from one, Ethereum, which is the most important thing since the web. And so I think it's no accident that NFTs then, I think, are different from ICOs. They won't collapse because they're steering clear of the regulation in a way that ICOs couldn't. And I think it's very interesting that NFTs are focused on pictures, not music. You would think music was the original digital file that was bought and sold. So you would think, well, that's obviously going to be where the crypto stuff is going to be. And weirdly, it's not. It was JPEGs or whatever. And I think it was that for a very good reason, that it circumvents all of the existing bullshit that's there with music. And we know that the last time this decentralization phase happened, it centered around music and file sharing in music. And we know that the decentralized platform got sued out of existence. Spotify then became a centralized platform that replaced it. Spotify originally was decentralized to a certain extent. And then the thing I always trot out is that the founder of Napster ended up being the president of Facebook, the most centralized platform on earth. And so that's why I'm skeptical that even if this results in the replacement of all the world's financial services as the internet of finance, you may still have centralized platforms that win. And Coinbase, I think.
Well, so that comes back to the point I was trying to make earlier about whether or not you need an intermediary, like from a factual sort of, technological or operational truth, whether or not one is desirable or not the same thing. But what I've come to suggest is a robust belief is it's better to be in that position, because then whether or not it's desirable, if it is desirable, it can exist and create value and prosper. Whereas in the alternate where it's required, you have no choice, right? And that choice, I think, is everything. And I think where some on both. So this is a super character, you know, massive oversimplification and caricature of the sort of the two camps. But the, you know, and if we had graphics now, there would be a picture of like a dinosaur in a JP Morgan turn of the century outfit on, you know, the traditionalists saying, oh, you must have an intermediary, you must have an insurance company, a bank, and all these different things that because they serve these purposes and they're very important and blah, blah, blah. And they would not be wrong completely, but, you know, they're stuck in that paradigm. And then you'd have the, you know, the neo-libertarian crypto dude who would be like, no, DeFi, everything, you need to get rid of all these things. And I think that they would also be wrong in the reality, but the vision, or the technological vision that they're building and they have, I think it, my view, I'd be this little weird guy in the middle saying, no, you're both wrong, but you're both right, is this is super interesting technology. This is going to change the world, yeah. But we need to figure out how, and you guys need to understand that sometimes we can have a discussion about this, about when and how and why intermediaries can be super valuable and value adding to the society or the civilization or the economy or whatever context you want to put around it. And you guys need to understand that, you know, just pure rent seeking and, you know, not adding value is inexorably going to be, you know, washed away by this technology.
Yeah.
I think we're in that middle period where these two groups are now sort of talking past each other. And I'm talking our book a little bit. There's an opportunity to be in the middle there. And, you know, navigate like a little furry mammal in a, you know, Cambrian context.
I think they're beginning to talk in the sense that Vitalik Buterin has a thing he calls the trilemma in crypto or whatever, which is that you can't have decentralization, security, and scalability. You can only have two of these three things.
Yeah,
and because of that, and they know that, we know that from all the pressure that things like NFTs have put on the Ethereum chain, that layer two that's emerging has the compromises in all sorts of tweaks and in all sorts of ways that again become more like a platform. But a platform is a different kind of intermediary from people going around shaking hands and smoking cigars and things like that. So there are modern intermediaries as well, but yeah. We've seen that even in things like real estate, where the platforms, the modern intermediaries, didn't manage to dislodge the people walking around with golf clubs. So the it's complicated, and I think, and for that reason, I think we can imagine a world that would be naive to think Visa goes away, for example. Visa is very like let's say one of the music labels in 2000. They have such power that they'll figure out how to.
Well, the other thing, and I don't. I can't believe like it. The 10-year younger me is like, who is this guy? But like, Visa is not like, why is we're a lot of, you know, really, well, no one will watch this, but if somebody did watch it, we get a lot of angry Twitter comments. But you know, Visa provides a super valuable service. I mean, the world today, or MasterCard, from these giant global payment pipes, they work. And they're not that expensive, and they're less expensive. And it's good that they have competition. I don't want to suggest that they should remain, but this idea that they're like innately evil, I just don't buy that. I mean,
but the efficient, there will be an efficiency gain.
Yeah. And they'll have to pick up their game. And I think they probably will. If they don't, they
companies will. Like that don't like when there's an efficiency gain, because that means less money.
Well, okay, so I would here I'd compare and contrast, and again, all of our, you know, people work with our strategic partners in financial services, you know, block their ears, but Marsh McLennan, reinsurance broking, and insurance broking is that. Over from my cold dead hands, will you take this opaque, inefficient market that I control? Visa, I don't think so. I mean, I don't want to say that they're like angels or anything like that, but it's a technology company. They'll want to stay ahead of it. They're going to lobby and like do what they can to not make it happen faster. But I think they have a plan, right? Yeah. Whereas I'm not sure these other guys have a plan other than like, you know, take it from my cold dead hands.
So I think one place of power that they have is that we know that there are, I'd say I like to view not the Vitalik trilemma, but the idea that blockchains offer you three things. They offer you security, they offer you infrastructure efficiency, and they offer you decentralization governance. That last one, the decentralized governance, is the trickiest one, because for it to really, really, really work, the laws need, you know, at the moment, governance is not just technology. It's technology plus lawyers and police forces and governments, an
army. Legislation is a form of technology, if you want to think about it. But, you know, and I would even go further and suggest, and I read an interesting article not so long ago on this, that I think the punchline, the risk of misrepresenting this article, was that like 80% of people or 85% of people prefer to work in very hierarchical organizations than the 15 or 20% that absolutely prefer working in a flat or what is it, a whole
holacracy
or whatever. And so anyhow, if that's true, even directionally true, even it's like 50-50 or whatever, it resonated with me a little bit, just anecdotally. Again, this idea of like, and I imagine the people that are building DAOs now, they're in that 15-20% camp, and they're right at the edge of it, right? This is something that really speaks to them and they're passionate about. But I think they're a little bit blind to the fact that a lot of people have no problem with hierarchies or centralized. But
not only do they
think the opposite, are very comfortable operating in that context. I don't know if that's biological or learned, but you know, it's real. It's part of the human experience.
But if you look at the Constitution DAO, which tried to buy the copy of the US Constitution, that had to become an LLC. So in parallel with this theoretical organization is a real legal entity, because these other organizations aren't real legal. So you've got this hybrid thing at the moment.
Yeah, it had a super huge flaw in the context of actually trying to acquire an asset, in which you became like, it was a winner's curse by definition, right? Yeah. You basically set the price for whoever wanted to buy it.
Exactly. Here's my maximum bid. Yeah. So yeah, radical transparency in auctions is not a great idea. So I do think this is a universal law of crypto, is that where it touches the real world, it either has to hide itself to not touch the real world. If you want to trade Bitcoin and really do it in a way that some trade, you've got to be very careful. But it also involves like downloading the user interface from GitHub and installing it and things like that. Nobody can be bothered to do that. So of course you have things like Coinbase, and Coinbase is not crypto. Coinbase is taking these theoretically unregulated assets and having regulated custody of them, because it has to do that, because it can be taken down in an instant because it's a regular web platform.
Yeah, so no, Coinbase is the Dean Witter of the 21st century.
Yeah, but those points where it hits the real world and it suddenly becomes normal mean that I think that's the dilemma rather than the trilemma, is you either have decentralization or you have good UI. I don't think you can have perfect UI and perfect decentralization. It's impossible.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
And because of that, we may see a repeat of what happened in the .com era, in the Web 2.0 era, post.com, which is that the platforms win again, even if the underlying infrastructure is decentralized.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the bets that you could make, is that, one of the things that we at Anthemus, you know, we looked at is that one future scenario is the decentralization world is that sedimentary layer that's now baked down for infrastructure, and that the money-making opportunities are in the orchestration layer that sits on top of it, or in the distribution that it's embedded in.
Yeah.
So I think those three components might be the winning one. And I think Coinbase was the first example of seeing something that was really not part of the crypto world become huge.
Yeah. Well, and even we saw, a smaller scale, but still, you know, crypto was really probably what made eToro. Robinhood came later, but you know, possibly even Robinhood is eToro and Robinhood, I would say, you know, like, you want to be reductionist about it, are UX companies, right? they created, you know, a fantastic customer experience and user experience, both of them in their own ways. They happen to do it for trading. They happen to be successful doing it for crypto, trading crypto assets, but like, that's what they are. It's, and so yeah, I mean, I think those are good examples of what you're talking about.
If I look at some of the wallet technology, I'm like, oh my God, I've lost my private key and that kind of stuff versus things like Coinbase, which is way more fun, frankly, than most E-Trade accounts are and things like that. Just little details in the user interface, how it updates, how slick it is. These things are really the cutting edge of UI, and they're a beautiful user experience. Yeah. And I think that's why there's so much speculation, because actually there is a lot of beauty there. That being said, I know that Jan Roncher, another infamous partner, his view is that certainly it isn't just Coinbase. There are some other exchanges that have greater volume that are really quite pure in terms of their crypto. So
yeah. But you know, here again, there's some models. I don't want to say everything's copy paste. It's not. But super cliched, history rhymes. Like that, I think he might be alluding to some of the decentralized exchanges and something. And if you look in the old world of financial assets, or stock markets, or bonds, you've got similar, like analogous. Again, I don't want to say copy paste, but analogous type constructs where you have, you know, a central order book at the New York Stock Exchange or at NASDAQ, but you have a whole bunch of like private liquidity pools and dark pools, and you know, and they're all, it's an ecosystem, right? And the ones that succeed, and there's multiple ones that succeed, they don't all succeed, but there's multiple ones that succeed, it's because, you know, it's complicated and there's nuanced use cases and there's just different types of users and different types of contexts in which, you know, different types of user experiences, to use that as a really broad term for a value proposition, are relevant. And, you know, that's where, as you know, I spent a lot of my time trying to figure out, you know, I'm not a crypto engineer or, you know, DeFi engineer, and I wouldn't, you know, pretend to, and I'm probably too old to start from scratch and learn it all. But, you know, I think that you let off this, and we're almost up on time, but saying, you know, this is, you know, it's getting interesting, but it wasn't already, and it's big and it can change everything. And I think what the really interesting part is that this technology, these infrastructures are real, they're being built, they're not just theoretical anymore. Some of them are breaking through, but I would hazard to say that what the real breakthrough will be when each of these camps, the sort of traditionalists versus the, you know, the DeFi maximalists, well, they can continue to exist, but the reality emerges in the middle where, to your point, where it's this hybrid, where it's using and leveraging what is unlocked by this new technology. And I'm saying this because this is what's happened. Carlotta was the first to really articulate this over the last 300 years since the Industrial Revolution. New technologies, this is how they've emerged, right, and changed the world. And very rarely has it been, if ever, by creating an entirely new disconnected paradigm from the one that existed before.
Precisely, and also it's about how many users you've got. So all that matters is people using these things.
Yeah.
But I think we're seeing, and to sort of summarize at my end, and then I'll come back to see what your conclusion is, that people are reading me. Often I think people are misunderstanding what I've been publicly saying at the moment as me being pessimistic, saying, oh, everything's going to crash. No, I do think there are three things happening at the moment. There is a cultural scene that's very like the early web, which is brilliant, because that means that something really new is happening. Yeah. There's a technology that's very like Web 2.0, i.e. it's file sharing based, it's decentralized, very, very similar technology. And then there's this third thing, which is speculation on the level of what we had in the dot-com boom and subsequent bust. That second bit, even if we do have a huge correction, and eventually we will, because this is a religion, and all that's keeping certain stock prices up are meme stocks, is the belief in these things. Now, okay, the beliefs can go on for thousands of years, so maybe they can stay at this level for thousands of years, but they have decoupled from fundamentals. So there is if you believe that markets are efficient and they do eventually recouple, then there will be a correction. But even if there is a correction, it's possible that Ethereum is still as important as the World Wide Web in terms of a paradigm shift in how the internet is used. And I would bet on Ethereum being the thing that survives. And maybe it's just the protocols that survive. Maybe it's ERC-20 and ERC-721, basically the non-fungible and fungible token protocols. They may be the legacy from this, but that would be amazing. That will change the world on its own.
Maybe just to build on that, to finish off and come full circle. And again, I think Carlota Perez was the first one, one of the first one to really, you know, articulate this, probably almost certainly not the first one to talk about or think about, but articulate this in a very robust, well-constructed framework, is that speculation, which in the financial markets, probably in our society, has this, such a, you know, negative connotation, is not neither negative nor positive, but it's something, well, it can be both. It's not intrinsically negative or positive, but it's a, but in a macro level, I think she'd agree with this. I hope I'm not misrepresenting her. It's a fundamental part of, you know, how change and how adaptation and resilience manifests itself. And it comes in cycles, it comes and goes. But from a societal point of view, this kind of speculation, I think, is enormously powerful, because yeah, out of it will come. And again, maybe this is where regulation comes in. This is where I hope I'm not being hubristic or complacent, where speculation can become very damaging or dangerous is when it causes great loss on a wide footprint. So, you know, sort of societal or economic loss. And the main mechanism, at least in the last 200-300 years, for that happening, when it did happen, is leverage. And there, you know, to say that there's no leverage in the crypto markets would be insane. Of course there is, but it's not. It's leveraged by people, you know, for the most part. There will be individual small people, big people that could, if there, you know, there was a puncturing of, if it is indeed a speculative bubble, and if there was any puncture of it, that will be sort of carried out, as they say in the markets. But as far as I can see for now, that's not generalized across. It's not anything like the house of cards that was the leverage that was in the securitization and the more, you know, started with subprime mortgages in the US, but the problem wasn't subprime mortgages in the US. It was that through leverage, there was contagion across the whole Western financial system, to the point where it was plausible, if it had not, you know, been remedied, that money would stop coming out of ATMs, so to speak. I'm not sure that that's the case here. So in that context, I've been sort of less, and not being a giant holder of any specific crypto asset, I haven't spent a lot of time, you know, I probably won't spend a lot of time sort of speculating, and since my job and my personality doesn't lend itself to day trading, which is nothing wrong with that, but it's a thing. It's kind of irrelevant. But it's interesting. I think your point is, you know, well taken, that so many people, that's all they focused on. And because that's what, you know, last 50 years, or the sort of the mediatized, you know, even before social media and the internet and all the rest, the mediatized financial world is, you know, what did the market do yesterday? It went up or down.
And when you have these beautiful interfaces, people are addicted to them and look at them.
Yeah, exactly. So I totally get it. I think it's fine. I think it's again, I don't want to belittle that kind of discourse. I think it has its place, but I think the speculative nature of what's going on now, I would frame speculative as a very positive thing.
Well, it could, I mean,
financial,
human, maybe more pessimistic
capital being brought to bear on, you know, what is, as you said at the start of the conversation, transformational, you know, technology.
But to summarize your point, yeah, if there were a correction in the speculation around memes and crypto, even if it was just memes and hadn't anything to do with crypto, this is not the 2008 era. It's more like the dot-com era. And what an amazing buying opportunity that would have been to have bought Amazon after that. And maybe you could say the same for something, let's say, like Ethereum.
In trading and investing, it's all about horizons, right? And making sure that your asset liability management is aligned to whatever horizon you have. And if you do that, you know, sort of betting against humankind has rarely been successful. Again, as long as your horizon and your ALM is aligned, if they're not aligned, it doesn't matter what happens. You'll probably get carried out irrespective of whether it goes up or down. So
I think we resolved the pessimism into the real story of optimism there. So that was great. Thanks a lot.
And, thanks, David. Good conversation, as always. Till next time. Yeah.